members, we don't have a quorum yet, so I'm going to have Representative Freiberg scribe his bill, and we can take action on it when we have a quorum. Thank you for being here, members, at this early in the morning. When I first started interning at the legislature in 1997, I interned for then-Representative Andy Dawkins, and I asked him how he put up with the sleep deprivation, and he said, well, I catch up with it on the weekends. So you've only got another 4 days, members. That's nice to know. Representative Freiberg, why don't you go ahead and explain your bill?
Sure. Thank you for hearing this bill. This is the Uniform Community Property Rights at Death Act. I think it might be helpful just to give a little background on common law versus community property before getting into the details of the bill. Basically, common law property is what we have in Minnesota, and it just means that if you have title and property, you keep it when you get married. But about 10 states have a community property system. When you get married in a community property state, each spouse gains a 50% interest in the property. Community property states are mostly in the Southwest, with the exception of Wisconsin, which recently created a community property system, and that's actually why there's an urgent need for this legislation. We're a mobile society now, so if somebody moves from a community property state like Wisconsin to a common law state, such as Minnesota, there's a lot of uncertainty as to what happens to the property after the death of a spouse. Gesundheit. Unless the common law state has adopted a law like House File 369. Minnesota has no statutes or cases on point, so this would create some certainty in the area. As a matter of policy and probably as a matter of constitutional law, moving to a common law state shouldn't by itself deprive a spouse of existing property rights. This legislation is not controversial. It has broad bipartisan and bicameral support. It was recommended by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in 1971 and is supported by the American Bar Association. And I understand Scott Nelson from the bar is here to answer to help answer questions if I'm unable to and if any committee members have questions. 14 states in the District of Columbia have adopted nearly identical legislation. In the absence of legislation such as this, there would be uncertainty about what happens to community property, and that could be resolved only by litigation. So this legislation would reduce the amount of litigation. There are advantages to community property, such as tax advantages for capital gains, and this legislation would help preserve those advantages. If you have parents who lived in Arizona and moved back, this preserves their community property. So if you like, I could just sort of walk through the bill real quickly.
Why don't you go ahead and do that, Ripson?
Sure. Section 1 describes which property is covered by the Act. It's fairly limited in scope. Section 2 elaborates on Section 1.
Representative Freiberg, hold up. We now have a quorum, so I'm calling this meeting of the Civil Law Committee to order. And will someone move the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. I'll go to 1-0. Representative Freiberg, the chair moves your bill, House File 369, and it is recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Go ahead and proceed, Representative Freiberg.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 2 elaborates on Section 1 by creating two rebuttable presumptions regarding which property is covered by the Act. Section 3 is the operative language. It basically says property acquired in a community property state is treated as community property upon the death of a spouse. The remaining sections are fairly technical. They do, for example, provide protections for good faith purchasers, for creditors, and the spouses themselves if they want to change the nature of their property. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members of the committee for Representative Freiberg. Go ahead, Representative Howe.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, this was first in 71. It was brought forward. Why hasn't it been enacted? I mean, why now?
Sir,
I guess
Representative
my question.
Freiberg.
Yeah, it was recommended by the Uniform Conference on State Laws in 1971. You know, they recommend a whole host of laws from the Uniform Commercial Code to other ones. There hasn't really been a pressing need for it in Minnesota, but Wisconsin recently adopted a community property regime, and just because of the number of people who are moving, you know, who might move back and forth between Minnesota and Wisconsin, the Bar Association among others, felt that there was an important need to do this now, particularly since we're a more mobile society.
Representative Howe?
Well, my only question is just because somebody else does it, I don't necessarily believe that we do it. I mean, we haven't followed suit in a lot of different manners like that, so that's my only question.
Representative Freiberg, if the Uniform Laws Commission told you to jump off a bridge, would you do it?
Representative Howe, I mean, if I understand your question, this wouldn't actually create a community property regime. This is very limited in scope. It just specifies what happens to property acquired as community property in the event one of the spouses dies. So it just creates more certainty as how the property gets disposed of as at death. But it only applies in that limited circumstance where the property was acquired in one of the community property states.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when did Wisconsin adopt this?
Representative Freiber.
Wisconsin didn't actually adopt this. They adopted a community. They, as I understand it, they switched from a common law property state, which is what Minnesota is, to a community property state. So that would be a much bigger change for Minnesota to make. This is a fairly minor change, just specifying what happens to property that may have been acquired in Wisconsin in the event one of the spouses dies after moving to Minnesota.
Representative Howe.
So, I mean, did they do it 10 years ago, 20 years ago? And I guess I'm getting to the point of why in 2013 are we looking this and not back whenever Wisconsin changed? What's the urgency today as opposed to 20 years ago?
Representative Freiberg.
I'm not certain when, maybe Mr. Nelson could come here. I'm not certain when Wisconsin made that change.
Mr. Nelson, pleasure coming up. Take a seat. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm Scott Nelson. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Mako, Krauts & Moore, and I have practiced in both Minneapolis and Hudson for about 14 years and was on the subcommittee of the Bar Association that worked on the Minnesota version of the Uniform Act that you have before you today. We have gone through it in quite extensive detail. We went through all the states that have adopted the act and made any changes to the Uniform Act and determined whether any of those changes would be appropriate for Minnesota version of the act. Representative, getting back to your question, the Wisconsin adopted what we call a Marital Property Act in, I believe it was effective in about 1989. And as Representative Freiberg has described, we do have, it is a prominent issue here because we live adjacent to a community property, or like I say, Wisconsin is called a marital property state, but essentially in substance it's a community property law. There's about 10 states in the country that have community property laws, and what this bill does is recognize the common law, which has been developed in case law throughout the country, that when you acquire community property while living in a community property state, it remains community property even when you move to a common law state such as Minnesota. So what we're trying to do from the Bar Association side is have a statutory framework both for attorneys and for title companies and for creditors and others who may be involved with estates that have community property and be able to recognize that there are certain rights that continue with that property if the participants have not proactively decided to change the nature of that property. And so what this bill does is it recognizes what our common law is throughout the country, but it provides a template, and I'd say just on my side of it, it provides a template for practitioners, because a lot of attorneys are not aware of the fact that their clients have properties that are actually subject to community property law rather than our common law property law here in Minnesota. And it obviously will have the most impact on married couples, because the surviving spouses will discover in some cases that they may have more rights in the property than they thought they had. And maybe just to describe real briefly what happens is, in a community property state, basically it doesn't matter how you title the property. It can be titled in the name of the husband or the wife or both. In any case, they own the property 50-50. That's kind of the basic presumption in a community property state. In a common law state like Minnesota, it does matter how you title the property. If it's in the husband's name, it's presumed to be the husband's property. If it's in the wife's name, it's presumed to be the wife's property. And then, of course, if it's jointly held, it has certain rights that are given to it by virtue of the title. But the issue is that in Minnesota, for example, if somebody dies and they have property just in their name, the attorney representing the estate may just assume that, well, okay, the decedent owned 100% of the property, when it might turn out that it was actually community property or the proceeds from community property, which also by common law carries forward the community property element to it. And so it may be, even though it was in the name of the decedent, it actually may turn out that by legal authority it's owned 50-50 by the husband and wife, and obviously that makes a difference on how they can dispose of it at death. And again, this act has no impact on the rights of husband and wife during lifetime. It only impacts how the assets can be dispersed upon death.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Okay, then seeing none, the chair brings forth again the motion that this House File 369 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. Actually, are there any members of the public who want to be heard on this before we move on it? Okay, then the motion is as stated. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Representative Urusso, are you prepared to proceed? Representative Urusso moves her bill, House File 212, that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. Members, there's an author's amendment. What's that? Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay. Representative Urusso, you should probably move this, but
yes.
Before you move it, this is your first bill presenting in front of a committee.
Yes.
In the House, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, do you have anything to say for yourself?
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you for all being here for this business so early in the morning. I have with me Ben Wagner and Michael Bryan from Reagan Tax Law, and I would like to move HF 212 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy.
Okay. And Representative Urusso, more important than that, do you have any treats to pass out?
Oh, yes.
The first bill?
I was unsure when you would like to do that operation.
Well, probably before we vote on it. But you don't have to do it right now, Representative Urusso. Good. Excellent. I'm impressed. Then, Representative Urusso, if you would, Representative Urusso,
I have not yet moved the amendment.
Okay, go ahead and move the author's amendment, Representative Urusso.
Thank you. I move that DE1, the amendment DE1. Thank you.
Okay, and all in favor of amendment DE1 in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. To the bill as amended, Representative Urusso.
Thank you. The bill is about what the deadline is for mailing in an appeal for tax court. Currently, the current statute states that it is an as-received deadline. The bill simply changes that to a postmark deadline, and I will let these gentlemen explain that in further detail.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Michael Bryan. I'm an attorney at Regan Tax Law and representative of the Bar Association.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Wagner, also Regan Tax Law, here as legislative co-chair for the Minnesota Bar Association Tax Action Committee.
Mr. Chair, in 2009, the Minnesota Supreme Court came down with a case called Langer, and that case decided that, or interpreted the statutory requirement for receiving an appeal from a Minnesota, or from an order from the Commissioner of Revenue, as the appeal must be received by the tax court by the due date. This bill would change that rule to a postmark rule. The reason for the change, or part of the reason for the change, is that many taxpayers that take their case to Minnesota Tax Court are unrepresented by counsel, and their only familiarity generally with the tax system is filing tax returns, and the rule for that is to have it in the mail by the due date. So that's, it's sort of to conform to that change. Also, this rule would conform to the Minnesota Department of Revenue's rule for filing appeals, administrative appeals, from commissioner's orders.
Mr. Wagner.
Well, I guess the only thing I would add to that is it's also similar to the rule for United States Tax Court. So in terms of your tax court venues, it would be a similar rule for taxpayers to understand and then execute.
Thank you. How many problems do you typically run into where you have clients that miss the deadline because of that? Or I guess it's you who yourself would miss the deadline, is that right?
But Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and the problem is that you don't have an opportunity to dispute your issue anymore. You're literally barred from proceeding. In fact, a lot of times in that situation, taxpayers' only remedy is an administrative one to then make a claim to the Department of Revenue and argue that there is some doubt as to liability. But at that point, you're sort of at the mercy of the department collecting the tax itself, and you really have no opportunity to get in front of a judge who can then make a decision about the merits of your case. This happens most often with unrepresented taxpayers, like Mike mentioned, but there are instances where practitioners, and in fact, about 3 weeks ago, I had a practitioner call me who noticed that we were assigned to helping the MSBA advance this legislative initiative, and she explained to me that she ran into this very same problem because her petition was not received by the court in a timely fashion, and subsequently she lost her hearing, and her issue will not be heard by the court.
Mr. Wagner, what percentage of appeals to the tax court are done pro se?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure I have that figure at my disposal, but I'm more than happy to get it and provide it to you. I do think it's a high percentage. I can't say for certain that it's higher than, say, 50%, but it is a high percentage.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Iruso. I have a point of clarification. We're hearing House File 212, but reference was made to Amendment DE1, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm looking for clarification about what that amendment says. I don't see anything before me.
Representative Iruso,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You should have another sheet. It's labeled at the top, H0212DE1 in the upper right corner. And it's, and the differences are in the details of the language, especially toward the bottom of that first side.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Please proceed. Any other comments from the testifiers? Okay. Any other questions from members of the committee? Okay, anyone from the audience or the public who wants to be heard on this bill? Someone who missed their filing deadline. Seeing none, then Representative Iruso has moved that House File 212 be recommended to pass and be referred to the committee as amended and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Congratulations,
thank you,
Representative Iruso.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Simon moves his bill, House File 290, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Please proceed, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is an update to the Minnesota False Claims Act. And those of you who were around in 2009 remember that we passed the False Claims Act. It's kind of a bipartisan reform effort. And for those of you not familiar or who forgot about the False Claims Act, it's really a unique vehicle that allows us to improve the state bottom line without raising anyone's taxes or without cutting anyone's cherished spending. It basically goes after fraud. And in particular, it goes after those who knowingly, and that's the key word, knowingly defraud Minnesota government, as by overbilling or other accounting practices. But it has to be knowing. It's not negligent. It's not careless. It's not accidental. It's knowing. And so we were the 23rd state in the country to adopt a False Claims Act in 2009. And the interesting history of the False Claims Act, as some of you remember, is it was around since the Civil War. It was originally called Lincoln's Law. And the reason was it was created by Congress during the Civil War to go after crooked contractors who sold bad mules or rotten food to the Union Army and profited by it. And it's morphed and evolved over the years to what it is right now, which is an incentive for people to root out and expose fraud. And what the False Claims Act does, just in terms of background, is it incentivizes whistleblowers to report that fraud, because if there's a successful claim, they will get some of the recovery. So in 1986, the federal government decided that it was a good thing for states to start to get into the business of passing their own False Claims Act and not relying solely on the federal False Claims Act. And the reason was, in certain programs that were administered jointly by the federal government and the state government, like Medicaid, or MA as we call it, there was a real incentive to root out and get at that fraud. So in Minnesota, for example, when it comes to Medicaid, it's a 50-50 split, as some of you know. Feds pay half, we pay half. It's not so in all states. In some of the poorer states, Mississippi, for example, it's a 60-40 split. And so what happens is, if either the state government or the federal government recovers by settlement or jury verdict any monies that were taken due to fraud, it's split on the basis of the MA split. So if there's Medicaid fraud and they recover $10, whether the feds do or the state does, it's a 50-50 split, $5 each. Well, what the federal government said starting in the 1980s is that if the states pass a False Claims Act that complies with certain conditions and terms that the federal government imposes on that False Claims Act, namely that it has to be at least as strong as the federal act, if we do that, if we go through that checklist, then we will get a 10% bump on our recovery. So in other words, now instead of getting $5 on that 10, we get $6 out of that 10 and the feds only get 4. It's a way for the feds to incentivize the various states to pass really tough and vigorous and aggressive False Claims Acts. So we did that in 2009, but hanging over us in 2009 was this idea, well, is our federal or is our state False Claims Act compliant? Did we comply with sort of the checklist? Were we at least as tough, at least as vigorous, at least as strong as the federal government's federal False Claims Act? And it took a while for them to run this by the federal government sort of machinery. But as you'll see here in the handout, on August 31st, 2011, the Department of Health and Human Services federally spoke and said, as we somewhat suspected for reasons I can get into, that no, there's some things that we need to do to change our False Claims Act. Number one, there were some intervening law changes since we passed it in 2009. But number two, there's some things back when we passed it, regardless of state law changes, that we might have done and that we can now do differently. So this letter came down about a year and a half ago, and I took this letter and I went to House Research and I said, could you draft a bill that does nothing more and nothing less than simply comply with this? That's it. There's nothing else in here other than doing what this letter says. And so I passed out another handout for folks here, and it's a real-world Minnesota example of what this bill aims to get at in terms of what we can gain. This was a case, I won't name the company and I didn't in the handout, but it was a large drugstore chain, and the federal government through federal law enforcement recovered about $2.4 million in damages attributable to fraud in Minnesota. Now, it was a nationwide case, but the part that was attributable to Minnesota was $2.4 million. And this table shows, just in this one case, which is a pretty small case actually, what Minnesota stands to gain. So with single damages, and under the False Claims Act you can get up to treble or triple damages, in this one actual case with actual dollars, the net gain, had we had this bill today that's before you, House File 290, been enacted, had we been fully compliant, we would have gained $242,352. Had it been double damages, about $484, triple damages, $727. Now, in a $37 billion or so biennial budget, that's not a ton of money, but it's not nothing. And it adds up over time to many millions of dollars. And if, as the state of Wisconsin did just a few years ago, they get a really big Wisconsin-only judgment in a case of this kind for $200 or so million, not just $2 or $4 million, you can see that the money really adds up. So the question is, do we want the money or not? If we don't, we can leave the False Claims Act that we passed in 2009 as it is. If we do, if we think we want that now and into the future, we have to pass what's in this bill. As I say, you can see the letter for yourself. I've spoken with several members of the business community, many of whom are here today, and they're watching this bill. They have no problems with it as of yet, but I've told them that if they do, they can come and talk to me. This has got another couple stops, including Commerce, and then Representative Hillstrom's committee as well, and Judiciary, so I'm happy to work with anyone as I did before. In 2009, I think, at the time I remember, I think I had 18 meetings with stakeholders just to make sure all that their concerns were met. I'm happy to do that many or more this time, but there are no concerns that have been announced to me yet. I've spoken with the Chamber of Commerce. I've spoken with other advocates, some in the room, some not, who say that they haven't discovered any issues here yet. But if they do, on the rest of the committee stops, I'm happy to talk with them. So with that, Mr. Chair, I guess I'll stand for questions or comments.
Questions from members of the committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, does this come with, you know, normally when we do something that conforms with the feds, it comes with strings attached? Are there any strings attached?
Representative Simon.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you, Representative Scott. No, there are no strings attached. We can take this. We can leave this. This isn't something we have to do unless we want the money. If we want the money, we have to do this. But nothing we're doing here gives up our power, our sovereignty, our ability to do anything. It's just the feds saying that because the federal law says that in order to get the money, you have to be at least as strong or at least as aggressive as the feds. And since the feds have changed their law, if we want to maintain that baseline, we have to make these changes. But no, we could say no, thanks, but no thanks. We'll keep our False Claims Act the way it is. We just wouldn't get that extra 10% bump. And as you can see from this one case, you know, a few hundred thousand bucks at a time really does add up. So that's really the proposition before you. Do we want the money or not?
Representative Scott.
Okay. I'm good, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then, Representative Simon has moved that House File 290 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Simon.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? It was my intent to ask for testimony.
Oh.
Are there members who wish to be heard on this? Not members, but members of the public. Okay, well, good. Dodge the bullet. Thank you, Representative Simon. And you are prepared, Representative Simon, with your House File 335?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Simon moves that House File 335 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Representative Simon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I think the bill's pretty much self-explanatory. House File 335 basically modernizes and conforms the jury exclusion discrimination provision to our Minnesota Human Rights Act. Ever since 1993, the Minnesota Human Rights Act has covered marital status and sexual orientation, and as far as I can tell, this was just a pure oversight. This language of the categories that are recognized in law that are immune from discrimination are the same as the Human Rights Act: race, color, religion, sex, national origin, economic status, marital status, sexual orientation, or physical or sensory disability. Those are the categories. For some reason, marital status and sexual orientation are left out. I want to make clear, members, for those of you somewhat familiar with the jury selection process, and we have members of this committee who certainly are, this doesn't mean you can't exclude a juror who belongs to these categories. You can always exclude someone pretty much with some exceptions for cause. So, of course, if a juror says, you know, the defendant is my sister, well, of course, you can probably exclude them. But this just conforms us to the Human Rights Act. That's all it does. There's nothing else. This is not a vehicle for anything else. I don't want anybody to be scared or spooked about that. That's all it is. If anyone attempts later on to attach anything to this, I will pull the bill. So you have my pledge for that. All it does is what it says.
All right. Questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there currently cases where this has been an issue within our courts of people being turned away to be jurors because of their sexual orientation or their marital status?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I know of none. Maybe there are others in the audience here who have experience with it. I know of none. This is just a conformity bill, but I can't point to an example.
Scott?
And if I might, who's bringing the bill? Is it you? Are you doing it on your own accord, or did someone initiate the process?
Representative Scott, someone else initiated the process. I honestly don't even know who. I got this from Senator Dibble in the Senate, who's carrying it in the Senate. It's on the Senate floor right now. It's cleared all the committees there. I don't know who gave it to him. I don't know the individuals. I don't know the groups. He just sent over the jackets, and I said, I'm happy to carry it.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Good, thank you.
Representative Simon, it's been a while since I've had to have any kind of fight over a strike for cause, and I can't recall the common law parameters for strikes for cause. I mean, my independent recollection is simply if a juror establishes that they're unable to be objective about the case in particular due to a personal experience with it, that they state, no, I can't be objective, I'm pretty much going to convict the defendant no matter what, or I absolutely don't trust cops, someone shows up in a blue shirt and a badge and they're a liar, would be adequate cause for a strike for cause. What is the common law understanding of those parameters for a judge?
Mr. Chair, I think you pretty much nailed it. As I understand it, it's someone who, to the judge's satisfaction, cannot render a fair and impartial decision. Interestingly, I have a friend whose father once desperately wanted to get out of jury duty. So he professed to have a bias in favor of the police and said, I think police always tell the truth all the time. I don't think they ever say anything other than the absolute truth. And he got his wish. He got off of the jury. So there's an opposite bias.
Understood. Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, it's been a very long time since I did select a jury, but if I'm remembering right, each side gets a certain number of what are known as peremptory challenges. So, in other words, you can just, for no reason, basically exclude a certain number of people. Each side gets to do that without any explanation. So am I correct in thinking this only comes into play if the other side usually raises it as an issue and says, wait a minute, you're picking off people because they're black, or you're picking off all the women on this jury, or something like that. So normally you don't even get to this unless there's some indication, and then the judge has to make a ruling about whether he or she thinks that's going on, or there's some process there where the person who's being challenged, the attorney whose judgment is being challenged, so, shall we say, has to sort of defend what they've done, or maybe you could just give us just a little bit about that.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly as I understand it. Exactly right. There's a peremptory challenge as of right, you don't have to show cause, but if the other side suspects that you're picking people off based on some impermissible category, they have to make a pretty strong showing, though. It has to be pretty strong. And it's not often successful.
Representative Liebling, I'm sure you recall handling Batson challenges when you were in there, which is directly relevant to this, and to which this would apply, not simply the strikes for cause. Is that right, Representative Simon?
That's correct.
Okay. Any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this just apply? What courts does this apply to? Does it also apply to U.S. District Court? Where level of court system does it go to?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, it would only apply to state courts. So I assume that would just mean state. The only place where we have juries would be state district courts.
Representative Simon, would this not apply to federal district court in cases where the state law provides the rule of decision under the Erie Doctrine?
Mr. Chair, I feel like I'm in law school here. That's a great question. I don't know jurisdictionally, possibly. It's possible.
Is there anyone in the audience who paid attention during the Erie Doctrine in law school? Okay. Well, I'm sure it's not particularly relevant. Representative Howell, any other questions? Okay, anyone from the public who wishes to be heard on this bill? And seeing none, Representative Simon has moved that House File 335 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, members.
Any other issues before the committee? Okay, members, thank you again for getting here so early after a long night. We appreciate it. We are again on tomorrow at 8:15. Committee is adjourned.